Thank you for joining us
Okay.
today, Asi. How are you doing today?
Very well. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Of course, it's our pleasure. Firstly, we'd love to know from you what motivated you to choose economics, particularly financial and development economics, as a career path. Also, reflecting on your experience in major financial institutions in the world, what do you think was a turning point in your career?
Okay, thank you. So, as you know, I'm Turkish, and Turkey is a country that goes through cycles of economic instability and financial crises. So, growing up in Turkey, I was naturally very interested in economics, and particularly in in the role finance plays in economics. So questions like, does financial sector perform an important role in contributing to economic development, or is it just a source of instability? How do you define financial development? How does it contribute to the well-being of individuals, firms, to long-term growth? How can you avert financial crises? What's the role of government policy? All these questions really motivated me to study economics, and in particularly the role of finance. So you also ask about the turning point in my career. I think it happened right after I got my PhD, and I joined a policy institution as opposed to joining the academia in university. I always enjoyed doing research, but I realized I was particularly interested in doing research and creating databases that contributed to policy making. And after all, we know that both the success and failures in development often have their origins in the policies. So getting the important central policies right is one of the major challenges. Also, combining research and practitioner experience allows one to temper policy recommendations to country circumstances and makes much for much better implications. I really realized that I enjoyed working in policy environments when I spent the last year of my PhD at the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland. Coming from a developing country myself, working in an international setting was really interesting. So at the end of the day, when I graduated, I joined the World Bank and I never looked back. So I think that was the turning point in my career.
Wow, that's so wonderful. Well, you spoke about really enjoying research and creating databases, and that leads me to the next segment, which is your work on financial inclusion. So in 2011, you created the Global Findex database that measures people's use of financial services across economies and over time. Since its launch, we've observed that the number of bank individuals rose from 51 to 76%. So what drove these changes in financial inclusion, and going forward, what gaps remain to be addressed?
Yeah. So we were just talking about financial development. I want to pick up from there. One of the major, challenges of financial development for policymakers is to create financial systems that are inclusive, because having access to finance, having access to different financial services is very important for individuals. It determines who can invest in their education, who cannot, who can really take advantage of promising growth opportunities by starting firms, and who cannot. So it's really a determinant of whether you will succeed because of parental wealth or political connections, or because of your own skill and innovation. And so By now, we also know that households and businesses that have access to financial services are able to withstand financial shocks much better than those that do not. So it's really a very important area. And I started working on financial access issues and inclusion issues in the year 2000 when I first joined the World Development Team on Institutions. At that point, it became clear to us that while we know a lot about financial development and we have a lot of data on finance, we knew very little about financial inclusion per se. And, you know, we didn't even know what proportion of adults in a country had a bank account. So it took us really 10 years before we could convince the development community that they should invest in collecting this data. So we wrote policy research reports, we wrote papers, we actually tried to estimate these numbers from population figures and overall aggregate number of you know, banking accounts, etc. And at the end of the day, that finally happened in 10 years with the financial support and collaboration of Gates Foundation in partnership with the Gallup Corporation. So it's really been gratifying, the whole process. But of course, ever since we've started collecting data through FinDex, we have seen that there has been significant advances in financial inclusion, not only because of in a number of few countries, but across the board, everyone is sort of improving their financial inclusion. So you ask, what has been the driver? And I think one of the important drivers has been the adoption of mobile money. So it's a large part of this increase. For example, mobile money has become a very important enabler of financial inclusion in sub-Saharan Africa. About 33% of adults in sub-Saharan Africa have a mobile money account. It was initially started as a way for individuals to send domestic remittances from one part of the country to another, but since then it has spread beyond those origins. So that's one thing. The other driver has been the growth of digital payments. This has increased during COVID pandemic, and it has also catalyzed the use of other financial services digitally, such as savings and borrowing money. Receiving a digital payment directly into an account really appears to provide a gateway to using other financial services. Now, as you also mentioned, of course, gaps remain. Account ownership has grown to 76% of adults worldwide. In developing countries, this is 71%. But this leaves, 1.4 billion adults that are unbanked. So we really need to sort of close these gaps, continuing to close these gaps. And FinDex does provide clues as to how to do this. It shows both opportunities and challenges. Now, one opportunity building up on what was the driver of financial inclusion is to leverage payments. So we see that money directly deposited into an account tends to stay there as savings till it's needed. Also, those people who have received money into their account make digital payments, and these types of accounts also make it easier to be approved for credit because they could be documented as regular income stream. Overall, in developing countries, adults receiving wage payments into an account also made digital payments on stored or saved money. So this is, digitizing cash payments is a proven way to increase account ownership. And importantly, millions of adults around the world still receive regular cash payments from employers, from government, as wages or transfers. So there is room to increase this. Now, in addition to this, though, creating an enabling environment is very important for this to happen. Both governments and financial sector service providers, including fintechs, would help expand financial access as well as usage, you know, by lowering barriers and improving infrastructure. Lack of money, distance to branches, insufficient documentation are all still cited by unbanked adults as important barriers. So inclusive access to digital identification, mobile phones could really help to reach hard-to-reach parts of the population. Governments, telecommunication providers, financial service providers, they must also invest in regulations and governance to ensure, you know, safe, affordable, and convenient products that, so that they're available to all adults. For example, the latest index showed that 1 in 5 adults in developing countries who received their wage payment into an account also paid unexpected fees on the transaction. So both businesses and governments need to ensure that digital payments are safer, more affordable, more transparent than cash alternatives, so we can continue to see this increase in inclusion.
Interesting. That was really comprehensive. Now, being from a developing country myself, India, I couldn't help but notice that while governments have implemented policies to increase the accessibility of banking, 15 to 20% of the new bank accounts in India tend to be dormant and others are sparsely used. So what role does financial literacy play in furthering financial inclusion, and how can governments effectively improve this?
Yes, so it's very important to address literacy issues because financially inexperienced users may not be able to benefit from account ownership if they don't understand how to use financial services. And they may, you know, they may fall into pitfalls and they may be taken advantage of. For example, about 2/3 of unbanked adults say if they opened an account at a financial institution, they could not use it without help. And 1/3 of existent mobile money account holders in sub-Saharan Africa say that they cannot use their account without help from a family member or an agent. So inexperienced users tend to be more vulnerable to financial abuse, and they may be asked to pay for services they don't need, or they may be hit by unexpected charges, as we just mentioned. So there's certainly need for both financial literacy and stronger consumer protection to build public trust in the financial sector and to expand access and use.
How do you think we can do this?
Well, there are financial literacy training programs, as you know, and there are many different ways of delivering these programs. The delivery of programs are important. Entertainment has been found to be an effective way of delivery. There's a lot of research in this, and we have actually covered this in one of our one of our updates in the ECA economic update series. And we also had a global financial development report on financial inclusion that covered that whole literature on how to improve financial literacy. And there's an active area of ongoing research.
That's really interesting. Finally, in today's day and age, how will the future of financial inclusion transform with technologies such as AI, API, Internet of Things, or even blockchain?
Mm-hmm. Well, technology has already transformed financial inclusion, whether it's through availability of mobile service providers or digitalization. You know, we've seen barriers come down, mobile phones and mobile money made physical distance less important. Digitalization brought down, you know, administrative costs and fees, making smaller transactions cost effective. Digital identification improved security and transparency, reduced documentation barriers. So fintech industry spurs innovation where, you know, the conventional traditional financial institutions fall short. Financial technology, fintech, and the blockchain-based decentralized finance are active new sectors. They're providing lower costs, quicker transaction, new asset classes, peer-to-peer services, elimination of minimum thresholds, equitable online access, and so on. And I expect this to continue, and this process is going to be very important. And in this process, it's going to be also very important to strengthen consumer protection and financial literacy to make sure that, you know, individuals can take advantage of these things without being taken advantage of.
Interesting. That's fascinating. Now, moving on, another focus of your work is studying small and medium-sized enterprises. And you found that while small firms create more jobs than large firms, their contribution to productivity growth is not as high as larger firms. Why is this the case?
Yeah, so this is true. We studied in a large sample of developing countries, you know, looking at firm level data suggests that while SMEs employ a large number of people and create more jobs than large firms, their contribution to productivity growth is not as high as that of large firms. So while job creation is, you know, a priority for policymakers, the challenge, of course, is not to create jobs per se, but to create better quality jobs, to promote, you know, productivity growth, growth in general. So increasing SME productivity requires a policy focus on the obstacles faced by SMEs. And there are a number of pro-SME policies. Some of them work and some of them don't work so well. I don't have all the answers, but I can tell you what I found out using my own research. So for example, institution building is an important one. Strengthening the investment climate for all firms instead of focusing and subsidizing on, you know, small firms is key. For example, information asymmetries are an important reason why small firms with potentially profitable opportunities find it difficult to access finance. Development of credit bureaus and better information sharing help all firms and expand access to smaller firms as well. Or, for example, restrictive regulations or taxes may be the reason why firms do not find it desirable to grow beyond a certain size. Another reason could be the need for business training and literacy programs to improve entrepreneurship and innovation and dynamism and make these firms more productive. Now, another very important area, which is a subcategory of institution building, but it's important to mention on its own, is financial development, because it's so important. And it's, we find that it's important, particularly for small firms. SMEs benefit disproportionately more than large firms in countries with better developed financial institutions. With financial development, small firms grow faster since their financial constraints are relaxed to a greater extent. And underdeveloped financial institutions limit firm size. And a competitive, well-functioning financial system actually makes it more likely for banks to go downstream and seek out new ways to serve smaller firms. And finally, I want to mention that direct government interventions to promote small firms and increase their productivity through subsidies, credit lines, partial credit guarantee programs, etc., have generally been less successful than and also more costly than believed. Developing the business environment and addressing information asymmetries, removing, you know, financial, legal, taxation barriers, leveling the playing field, providing entrepreneurship and literacy training seem to generally work better in improving the productivity of the sector and leading to firm growth.
Interesting. So do you think these same policies could also provide SMEs with resilience during financial crises or any other crises that tend to favor more productive firms?
Yeah, so this is a very good question and a very timely one. We know crises pose unique challenges. For example, we have been looking at how firms were affected by the COVID crisis, and then which firms received government support and what impact this had on firm recovery using World Bank enterprise surveys, because we were also able to survey institutions through different rounds during the COVID crisis, where no other data is generally available for a long time. So this is an ongoing study, but already some interesting results are coming out. First of all, we do find that the crisis had a heterogeneous impact on firms. Smaller and younger firms were hit much harder than larger and more established firms. Economic activity was reallocated toward more productive firms, as you mentioned, during the crisis. So in a way, it's a silver lining, because we find evidence of some creative destruction, and firms with high pre-crisis labor productivity fared better experiencing smaller drops in sales and employment than firms with lower pre-crisis labor productivity. And importantly, countries with a strong competition environment saw greater extents of creative destruction. So the extent of creative destruction was also greater in countries where firms were subject to greater competition. Now, of course, what happens during the crisis and how governments try to help firms also makes a big difference. So we examined the determinants of receiving government support, because a lot of governments around the world very quickly started supporting firms, whether through wage subsidies, cash subsidies, cheap credit, and what have you. And it's very interesting, though, that we found that government support measures implemented in response to the crisis went to less productive firms and larger firms. You could say that, well, perhaps they actually did that intentionally because they were trying to sort of reduce the impact of the crisis. But this is true even after, when we control for the drop in sales or drop in employment, even within those groups, we see that the support went to less productive firms and larger firms. So this is a bit of a concern, obviously. We are worried that government support measures during COVID-19 crisis may have had adverse impact on competition and productivity growth. And in ongoing work, we're exploring whether receiving this government support subsequently improved firm performance. And preliminary findings suggest that only if they were phased out fairly quickly. So the policy advice is that as economies recover, it's important for policymakers to phase out support measures as soon as possible and focus on, fostering a competitive business environment while continuing to protect vulnerable households. In this way, in such an environment, this is going to be key to recovery, because you protect the competition environment and productivity growth, and also cushioning the transition process, and it makes the economy then more resilient to future crises and paves the way for sustainable long-term recovery and growth. So this is still ongoing work, but I try to give you some flavor of what's happened and what we think should happen in the crises to come just learning the lessons from this particular crisis that we just suffered through.
Yeah, thank you for that. Those are very interesting, but also surprising results. So as a former chief economist for the Europe and Central Asia region in the World Bank, you've been at the forefront of providing intellectual leadership and strategic guidance for the region. So ahead of the ECA economic update for 2023, what do you forecast to be the major challenges and opportunities for the region?
So ECA is a region where many countries are still transitioning to market economies. So inherently, long-term challenges remain in strengthening institutions, strengthening governance, enabling markets, fostering competition. This is also a region where, the population is aging. So related demographic challenges, of course, are going to be important going forward. But, keeping these in mind, the region has also been experiencing and coping with a number of challenges, a number of crises. First, the pandemic, then the war that's still continuing, and then the recent earthquake in Turkey. So these present important shorter-term challenges, but also opportunities. First and foremost, I think strengthening the stability and nurturing economic recovery necessitates shoring up macro stability, fortifying macroeconomic buffers and prudential measures. A lot of these countries need to keep inflation under check. Establishing credibility of institutions and policies is very important for that. But also, given the ongoing crisis, it's important to ensure the regional trade and investment linkages remain intact. And it's an opportunity to think of ways in which greater regional integration and connectivity can be established, because after the pandemic, the tensions between the East and the West, supply chains are being reorganized. So this is giving a lot of opportunities, some of these countries in the region, to be connected and introduced into new supply chains, which is a great growth potential. So this is one category of challenge in opportunity that I see. Now, another important area that we need to keep in mind is, boosting human capital and ensuring recovery is inclusive is another priority. Since the pandemic, both health and education have taken a significant hit, and this remains a priority. It needs to be bolstered. We need to catch up with all the education gaps that emerged because of the pandemic. Obviously, health is still lagging, but also social protection policies, the policies to protect the vulnerable and nurture, labor market recovery are essential in promoting equitable recovery after the crisis. And I have to say, in this category, I'm going to also put migrants, refugees, and other displaced, and the challenges associated with integrating these people in this war-torn and disaster-stricken region, because it's such an important major challenge in promoting inclusive recovery. And finally, while we're grappling with these, immediate challenges, we have to remember that the region needs to secure a sustainable future by bolstering a green and resilient recovery. So we need to keep the focus on improving energy efficiency, reducing waste and energy consumption, and technological innovations to transition to cheaper, cleaner, more reliable power and reduce reliance on conventional energy. And the recent crisis has certainly underlined the importance of making sure the efforts continue along this dimension. So obviously each of these things are huge challenges, and they all are worth writing reports and huge research agendas on their own. But I tried to sort of summarize in a nutshell for you some of the challenges that are that I see for the region.
Interesting. So you mentioned social protection policies. Would you be able to elaborate on that a bit more, and what kind of policies?
Yes. Yes, that's a very important area. And we actually have a recent paper looking at this issue, and we did one of the ECHA updates last fall on social protection. Now, countries in the region responded to COVID-19 pandemic by implementing social protection packages with a substantial contribution for job protection policies, such as, you know, wage subsidies funded by the government. Now, so we looked at the impact of these, you know, social protection policies, and particularly job protection policies. And we do see that they are associated with less unemployment and lower poverty in the short run. But at the same time, we know that this may come at the cost of, efficiency and growth in the longer run, because income protection policy programs, such as cash transfers or other social protection programs, may be better at addressing the needs of vulnerable groups. And particularly if the impact of the pandemic is structural and permanent, forcing businesses to adopt new business models, such as relying on digitalization or using fewer workers, then this will require significant reallocation of resources from less successful, less viable firms to more successful, more productive firms. So policies that rely on job protection then may prevent, you know, this reallocation to better performing industries and slow the recovery, even if in the short term, you know, they may be okay in preventing unemployment and preventing an increase in poverty. So we were thinking, and our recommendation is that policy packages that combine, you know, a guaranteed minimum income with labor market policies that facilitate job transitions may be better at helping countries address long-term challenges and grow, while at the same time protecting the vulnerable households. So it's a combination of these types of policies, both protecting incomes and protecting, providing resources to the vulnerable households for the transition periods.
That makes sense. Now,
There is much, much more. If you're interested in this area, I suggest that you read the paper with Michelle Nokshin and Ivan Tore and myself, where we discussed these issues in greater depth. It just came out at the Journal of Comparative Economics. So,
I'll definitely try to have a look at that. So another paper of yours that I found very interesting was Determinants of Banking Crises, where you pointed out evidence of increased banking sector problems because of high inflation. And you suggest strict monetary policy that places checks on inflation in developing markets. However, such inflation stabilization programs are often accompanied by an increase in the nominal interest rate that could also increase the likelihood of a crisis. So how do you think central banks can strike a balance between the two?
Yes. Well, yes, this is the million-dollar question. So, how to deal with inflation pressures without causing a recession, hampering recovery, or generating financial crisis, as you mentioned. Now, we have seen rising inflation all across the world, but particularly in developing countries because of the pandemic support, increasing debt levels, worsening commodity prices, currency depreciation amid the fallout from the war. So, there is tightening global financial conditions. There is the higher interest rates that we see in the developed world. So this is also leading to a decline in portfolio flows to developing countries. Overall, it's a very challenging environment. So on the one hand, it's very costly to have runaway inflation, obviously, both in terms of investor confidence, consumer confidence, and also the impact on income distribution and poverty, because as you know, inflation hits the lower income and fixed income part of the population the most. And it really, worsens the income distribution. Now, on the other hand, though, monetary tightening needs to be done very carefully, not to make things worse, not to generate a crisis. So I think what it requires is very credible, very competent policies to shore up macroeconomic buffers. It requires independent central banks for credibility, very close monitoring, very good, clear communication on policy directions to the markets. And very importantly, I want to underline this, fortifying macroprudential measures and supervision. So even the U.S., as you know, there's been difficulty in the banking system while increasing interest rates. Higher interest rates can make banks much more vulnerable, particularly if they have not been paying enough attention to interest risk, or if they have been betting that the interest rates would stay low, as we've seen in the case of, Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, and most recently, the First Republic Bank. So all three of these banks had assets with long maturities, which really suffered in value with the rising interest rates. They had a high percentage of uninsured deposits, and they did not manage their interest risk well, to say the least. So this, of course, underlines the importance of prudential regulations and good supervision in this process, because with good risk monitoring, adequate capital buffers, and resolution planning, the crisis could have been averted, but of course, once you find yourself in the midst of the crisis, things become much more difficult.
Interesting. Thank you for those insights. Now, as we near the end of this episode, I would love to shift focus from your work to know a little bit more about you. So moving forward, what policy institutions and areas of research are you excited to explore?
Okay. I have a wide range of interests, but these days, I'm researching COVID response and the impact of government policies on firms and households, which firms received COVID support, how did they fare? I'm also interested a bit more on sort of brushing up my work on deposit insurance, given what's been going on in the US and all the active discussion on how to design deposit insurance. I'm writing a review article on deposit insurance and market discipline, which I think is going to be of interest for policy. And another area is green finance. So I'm interested in the role of financial sector in the whole transition to green economies.
Wonderful. Now, a lot of our listener base are aspiring economists, and a lot of them are also women. Being one of the most highly cited researchers and a highly influential economist, what advice do you have for women pursuing economics?
Well, thank you so much for that. I have a daughter who studied economics and is now doing her PhD in finance. So that's a question that I ask myself often. I don't think I have an easy answer for women or men for that matter. I think there is a lot of luck involved, so we cannot ignore that. But I believe it's important to do what you love, work hard, and persevere. You know, inevitably there will be setbacks. There always are setbacks. In my experience, those who succeed are the ones who have a passion and determination to keep going. So,
true. Finally, something we ask everyone on our podcast: what gives you hope?
Well, you know, people give me hope. Whether it's the young researchers like yourself that I meet in throughout my profession, or just colleagues that I work with regularly. I've been lucky enough to collaborate for many years, and I've been fortunate to work with people who have a lot of passion for what they do, and they take a lot of pride in their work. So it makes for a very stimulating environment and an innovative work environment. And it gives me hope and keeps me happy.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Asul. This was a wonderful
conversation. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.